Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to the Woodside Petroleum Limited 2017 half-year results presentation. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. There will be a presentation followed by a question and answer session. At which time, if you wish to ask a question, you will need to press star one on your telephone. Please be advised that this conference is being recorded today, Wednesday, the 16th of August, 2017. I would now like to hand the conference over to your first speaker today, the Managing Director and CEO, Mr. Peter Coleman. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining us for our 2017 half-year results. As you would have seen already, we've released our half-year report and slide pack onto the ASX this morning. Joining us on the call is our Acting Chief Financial Officer, Anthea McKinnell. You'll see the standard disclaimer on slide two and a quick reminder that this presentation does include some forward-looking statements and that for our reported numbers are all in US dollars, unless we state otherwise. If we go back at our investor briefing day in May, we introduced to you three horizons outlining our plan to build and deliver shareholder value over the next decade and beyond. We've already begun to action those plans, and today is a good opportunity to update you on our progress. First, let's run through some of our achievements in the first 6 months of 2017. As you can see in the financial headlines on slide three, our net profit was up some 49% to $507 million, and our interim dividend for the first half was $0.49 per share. Operating cash flow rose 3% to more than $1.2 billion, and free cash flow was up 170% to $445 million. We continued to reduce our unit production costs down some 6% to $4.90 per barrel of oil equivalent, and our free cash flow break-even price was $34 per barrel of Brent. On slide four, you can see that our reputation for operational excellence is underscored by the fact that our total recordable injury rate for the first half has dropped to a record low. Our facilities continue to perform strongly, with Pluto achieving several daily and weekly production records and gas unit production costs at the North West Shelf dropping some 13% to $3.30 per barrel of oil equivalent. Our ability to manage risk and volatility has been shored up by our low break-even cash costs of sale at $9.60 per barrel of oil equivalent, and we've executed midterm sales and purchase agreements for up to 16 cargoes for delivery from 2017 through 2019. Significantly, we finalized a long-term sales and purchase agreement with Pertamina, which will see Woodside become a major supplier of LNG to Indonesia. We'll get into more detail later in the pack about our prospects for near-term value growth, both in Australia and internationally. You can see from this slide that Wheatstone commissioning is nearing completion, and we've progressed our plans for the Burrup Hub with significant developments in the North West Shelf, Browse, and Pluto. In Senegal, we've completed a five-well drilling campaign, and in Myanmar, we've achieved strong flow rates on two appraisal wells with further drilling planned this year. On slide five, Woodside continues to focus on long-term performance and is delivering peer-leading results across key financial metrics. Here we've outlined EBITDA margins and return on average capital employed. Slide six shows the rebalancing that we've been expecting is actually occurring as demand growth remains strong and inventories trend lower. We've been saying for some time that we expect oil prices to be range-bound between $45-$60 per barrel, and this leaves Woodside well-positioned with the low break-even price that I mentioned earlier. On slide seven, you can see that although the global LNG market is well supplied at the moment, we expect further growth in demand from Asia. The long lead times on projects mean that we'll need to get ready to meet rising demand over the next couple of years, and that's why we're now working to progress the very lowest capital-efficient projects that we can, low-cost developments that we expect will deliver increased production right when it's needed. That was part of our strategy out to 2021 across what we've called Horizon One. Slide eight outlines how that fits in with our mid to long-term plans for future growth that would deliver value to our shareholders. With that as an opening, I'll hand over to Anthea to talk about our financials in more detail, and after that I'll just take you through the progress of some of our 2017 priorities.
Thanks, Peter, and good morning all. Our financial results for the first half of 2017 underscore much of what we discussed at our recent investor briefing day in May, including Woodside's capability as a low-cost, high-margin producer, ability to generate strong free cash flows, and strong capital discipline. So let's start with slide 10 and a brief overview of our financial performance. Reported profit for the first half was $507 million, an increase of 49% compared to the same period in 2016. Sales revenue was down in aggregate by $45 million on the previous period. Pleasingly, though, higher average realised prices for the period of $43 per barrel of oil equivalent had a positive impact of $139 million on sales revenue. This was offset by the impact of lower sales volumes and the absence of one-off price review payments which were present in the first half 2016 results. Lower sales volumes were attributable to lower LNG production, lower North West Shelf pipeline gas volumes as a result of changes in venture equity and customer demand, and operations discontinued in 2016. Production costs were $33 million lower, in part due to the impact of discontinued operations, reduced equity interest in North West Shelf pipeline gas, and reduced turnaround activity. Exploration drilling for the half predominantly focused on exploration and appraisal in Senegal and Myanmar. Overall exploration expense has decreased principally due to lower well write-offs, lower general permit activities, and lower seismic activities. Lower depreciation expenses also made a significant positive contribution to our first half results. This was largely driven by reserves movements, and these included greater Prudhoe developed reserves increasing 19% at the end of 2016 following start-up of the PLA-05 sidetrack well and the booking of greater Enfield reserves following FID in June 2016, partially offset by higher production volumes from Okko FPSO and the North West Shelf LNG. Turning to slide 11, our focus on low-cost production has been a hallmark of Woodside's performance in recent years. Sustained structural cost reductions and operational excellence continue to underpin our cost base, as demonstrated by unit production costs reducing 6% relative to H1 2016. And we continue to target further operational cost reductions across our assets. Slide 12, low production costs and high quality assets underpin our gross margin of 48%, up from 43% in the first half of 2016. And as Peter mentioned earlier, we continue to maintain a peer-leading EBITDA margin, which is supported by a low cash cost of sales. Moving to slide 13, the strong cash generated from our assets has allowed us to maintain our 80% payout ratio for the current dividend. We've declared a fully franked 2017 interim dividend of 49 cents per share. This is a 44% increase compared to H1 2016. Next slide, 14, looking at sources and uses of cash, our strong operating cash flows have allowed us to fund the 2016 final dividend from free cash flow generated of $445 million for the half. On slide 15, we maintained focus on our cost of operations and capital discipline, and this allowed us to continue to produce our assets and invest in growth at an extremely competitive break-even cash cost. This chart demonstrates our strong competitive position relative to our peer group. Turning now to the balance sheet and slides 16 and 17, we continue to maintain a strong liquidity position of $2.6 billion at period end, consisting of available cash and undrawn debt facilities. And gearing at 24% has remained within our target range of 10 to 30%. Our portfolio cost of debt is currently a competitive 3.4%, and we continue to diversify our sources of funding and manage our debt maturity profile as appropriate. And finally, on slide 18, our estimated four-year total investment expenditure remains unchanged. Our expected four-year spend on Wheatstone has increased slightly. However, this is expected to be offset by a reduction in our base business expenditure. We're investing in near-term growth, with approximately 70% of total capital expenditure in the first half relating to sanctioned projects that are expected to underpin approximately 15% production growth between 2017 and 2020. So it's been a strong half for us that's seen profit increase by 49%, a 44% increase in interim dividend, together with a reduction in our portfolio unit production costs. Our strong business performance and capital discipline are important contributors to the development of Woodside's growth portfolio. And with this in mind, I'll now hand back to Peter to talk to the progress we've made on our 2017 priorities.
Great. Look, thanks, Anthea. We talked at the start of the year about our priorities of Wheatstone, Senegal, Myanmar and Pluto. And, of course, in the first half of 2017, we added Browse to that list. On all of those developments, we've seen good progress so far. At Wheatstone, the platform and pipeline are fully operational and the final commissioning of LNG Train 1 is well advanced and nearing completion. Of course, Chevron is leading, but we've had 25 Woodside people embedded to aid the safe and reliable startup. And when fully operational, Wheatstone LNG is expected to contribute more than 13 million barrels of oil equivalent to Woodside's annual production. That's one of our Horizon 1 projects, which we've said are being developed over the next 4 years. Senegal on slide 21 is another that falls into this category, targeting first oil in 2021 to 2023. And it's been a busy 6 months for the joint venture in Senegal, with the five-well drilling campaign now completed. Woodside has recently taken over as the SNE development lead, and we're planning the transition to operator. The joint venture is reviewing the potential for further drilling operations next year. We classify Myanmar on slide 22 as one of our Horizon 2 projects to be developed between 2022 and 2026. So far, we've had a 100% success rate with our exploration drilling program in Myanmar, and we've just in recent weeks had our third discovery in the Rakhine Basin, where Woodside is the largest acreage holder. Our holdings have expanded as we're completing the acquisition of three blocks, AD1, AD6, and AD8, and more drilling is planned during the latter part of this calendar year. On slide 23, we continue to progress Pluto expansion options and are considering the relative merits of capacity enhancements, a small LNG train or a transfer pipeline to the Northwest Shelf. We've run tests during first half that have shown that the capacity is there in the plant if we opt to enhance the existing facility, but we're also considering expressions of interest for a small standalone train, and we'll hopefully be able to make a decision on the concept to move forward in the second half of this year. We began talking in the first half of 2017 about the prospect of bringing Browse gas through the Karratha gas plant. And it's pleasing that the Browse joint venture is very much aligned on this as a reference development concept. Of course, as you can see on slide 24, the Northwest Shelf has its tolling proposal out to Browse, Scarborough, and another joint venture. And the next 12 months will be critical in determining what will move forward there. The Browse joint venture and Northwest Shelf project are currently progressing a joint technical feasibility study, and Woodside's targeting concept select in the second half of 2017. In summary, we've had a busy agenda for the first half of 2017 as we deliver on the plans we outlined to investors earlier in the year. Those plans are all about delivering strong returns to shareholders and laying the foundation for value growth in the years ahead. Our existing business is performing well, and we're pursuing cost-effective developments that will be ready in time to meet growing global demand. When we consider recent trends in global market, it reinforces this strategy. And there are plenty of signs that the oil markets are continuing their slow and steady rebalancing. Since February, we've seen drawdowns in both US and OECD oil inventories. And last month, in July, we saw the largest monthly US crude stock draw down for more than 3 years. The pace of growth in oil production in the U.S. is slowing and costs are rising as U.S. activity picks up. And since reaching an agreement in November last year, OPEC has had a generally high level of compliance on production restraint. OPEC has also said it will refocus on reducing export deliveries. And globally, oil demand remains strong and it's on track to grow by about 1.7 million barrels per day in 2017. For LNG, the market will need to absorb significant new supply over the next several years. However, demand continues to rise, particularly in Asia-Pacific. Traditional buyers are still there to underpin large new projects, but the real growth is coming from emerging markets and new LNG buyers. Lower prices and new government policies supporting the use of gas are contributing to stronger than expected LNG demand. China, India and Pakistan all have significant upside potential for LNG demand growth in the mid to long term. On the supply side, some planned startups in the US have been delayed and have lowered their projected output. And this is all occurring at the same time that we're seeing a shift in LNG trading dynamics as the market becomes more mature and more liquid. Both sellers and buyers are becoming more adept at using the new flexibility in the market to manage price, and we expect the market will continue to mature and that prices will become more responsive to market pressure over time. All these factors reinforce the strategy that we unveiled at our investor briefing day in May, when we explained how we're preparing now to meet the emerging demand in the years ahead. Woodside is really in a superb position to do this, with cost-effective brownfield developments and promising greenfield opportunities. As we've outlined today, we're able to maximise the value of existing infrastructure as we progress the development of the Burrup Hub, while also developing new projects in Australia and internationally. We're getting ready to meet the supply shortfall that we expect is going to emerge in the years ahead, and that we'll see strong signals from over the next 2 years or so. So with those introductory remarks, let's throw to Q&A.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. If you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for a name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press the pound or hash key. Your first question comes from the line of Dale Koenders from Citigroup. Please go ahead.
Good morning. I was hoping to start with you could provide a little bit of a more granular update on Wheatstone. Do we actually have a gas flow from offshore started? My understanding is that you need full field flow rates to actually finalise the commissioning of the cold end of the LNG train, and that's probably a couple of month process.
Good morning, Dale. Yes, we do have flow into the plant. So we're currently going through drying out the front end of the plant at this point, or what we call the warm end. And so we've got gas flowing through the acid gas removal system. It's now in drying out the mole sieve beds, and so the next step then is to put it into the cold end of the plant. We've begun loading refrigerant into the cold end of the plant, and we're starting to go through the final commissioning of the compressors there. So, as you know, once that work is complete, then basically it'll be just a flow through the plant. We'll start making first LNG soon.
Okay, so that ready for startup really does sound like it's a couple of weeks away, not months.
Well, look, our expectation is we're targeting first cargoes in September. The question will be just how quickly the plant can ramp up and maintain reliability for us, but it's pretty clear as a joint venture we're targeting first cargo in September.
Okay, and then in terms of the timing for train 2, 6 to 8 months afterwards, so that's 6 to 8 months after September, is that right?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And then finally, sort of for the group production of about a 15% growth from 17 to 2020, I mean, that guidance was provided at the strategy day, maybe when we were thinking about midpoint of your production guidance at that time, but obviously as Wheatstone slides a little bit in terms of time frame versus prior guidance to start the middle of the year, do we think about that 15% growth on the ultimate outcome for 2017 or that initial production guidance? So should we be thinking about a lower number in 2020 versus the 100 MMBOE targets set before?
Yeah, from memory, Dale, it was based on the midpoint of the production guidance at that time. So, you know, any movements up or down this year will, I haven't factored into that, and I wouldn't be changing the guidance itself. It was based on the midpoint of the production guidance. And so that's, the focus here is the end point. But the starting point hasn't changed.
Okay. And then finally, just on Myanmar, your exploration discovery, you sort of spoke about this sort of building resource towards a commercial development opportunity. Do you think you've got there now after this discovery?
We're currently in Block A6. We're drilling the second well in Block A6 at the moment. It's actually a fairly short well with respect to time. We'll know after this well whether we're at that commercial point. We will have to go back and have discussions with government about both fiscal terms and gas pricing into the marketplace, and we're getting ready to do that. We've already had some initial discussions on it. But assuming a success case on the current well in Block A6, we'll be ready to be inputting development proposals in front of government as to the pathway forward.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Nick Burns from UBS. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Peter. Just interested in your macro comments on oil and LNG markets. You're sounding incrementally more positive on oil pricing in the medium term. Is that a fair assessment? And just in relation to that, how do you see Woodside being positioned to benefit from potential high oil prices in the medium term? And then just the second question will be on your macro view of LNG markets. Previously, you flagged that you were willing to potentially look further downstream in the pursuit of markets. Is that still your aim? Are you looking at potentially looking at FSRU investment, things like that, in order to drive sales for your LNG business? Thank you.
Well, firstly, on oil prices, Nick, the positive thing is we said a year ago we were expecting a rebalancing to occur in the oil market during 2017, and that's starting to occur. I think a lot of people were hoping it would be in the first quarter. Well, it's been second quarter. Some of the reasons it's been delayed a little is some of those OPEC members that are not under the quota compliance requirements are producing more than expected, and we have pretty much a five-year low with respect to volumes that are out due to either geopolitical or other disruptions. And so if you actually have a look at volume out of the market at the moment, it's down to about 2 million barrels per day, and typically it's been running at about 3 million barrels per day. So all of those factors have just pushed it out a quarter, but you've seen rebalancing in the second quarter. There is still some pressure as we go through the end of this year into early next year, and so there is an expectation that, first quarter next year will be a little uncertain in the marketplace, depending on how U.S. producers respond, and they start to hedge their forward books going into the second half of this year. So that's a bit uncertain for us at the moment. So I would say we've been range-bound between 45 and 60, and that's kind of what we expect to see really through the first half of next year, to be fair. There's a number of other factors out there. Early signs, you're starting to see gas oil ratios starting to increase in the Permian Basin. You've got to believe that the dance there of people moving assets around and consolidating assets has probably run its course for the most part. And then, of course, you've had a significant production increase coming out of Brazil during the period, as new projects there have come on stream. The key here is that there's no really big, significant conventional oil projects being developed at this point of time. And so this rebalancing is occurring, fairly quickly. And once it gets momentum, it'll be hard to stop simply because of the fact that there's been no new production coming in. So it will occur. It's starting to occur. The thing I would be really careful of and remind people, We often look at five-year averages on crude oil inventory. What we need to do is look at the five-year average of drawdown days, or how much you've actually got in inventory as a function of the amount of demand. Those numbers are actually much closer to the five-year average, simply because demand has increased over the period. So simply just using inventory as a number doesn't reflect the fact that demand itself was actually increased over the same period. So that's oil price. With respect to where Woodside is positioned, of course, as we mentioned in the opening, our margins are still very, very good. And so, any upside in oil price flows directly through to the bottom line for us. On LNG markets, we've got another year and a half or so as new production comes into the LNG markets. I can only go by what's happened over the last 12 to 18 months, where we've had new production coming in and the market's been able to soak it up. you know, in recent times you've seen Bangladesh come into the market. They just announced yesterday that they've completed the tie-in pipelines, the first of the tie-in pipelines for their FSRUs. They've just put tender out for a third FSRU going into their market. Pakistan has a relationship now with Qatar that will, you know, we think over time will probably soak up a lot of the incremental Qatari volumes coming into the marketplace. So the market's showing tremendous resilience at this point, and the spot prices have held up, you know, pretty much over $5.50, and they're over $6 today. So you can see the market's, you know, actually found a balance point, I think. What will the next 18 months mean? Well, as we mentioned, some of those projects that were expected to come online out of the US this year will not come online. And so that's, I think, taking just a little bit of pressure off in the marketplace. But we are seeing the potential for more volumes out of the US to flow into Asia-Pac. So as the Panama Canal change some of their restrictions on cargoes going through the canal. So I think, you know, all of those things just say, hey, it's going to be a fluid market for a while. You need to be well positioned. You need to have sophistication in what you do. And whatever you do, don't let the buyer be the one that determines when they come pick up a cargo from you, because they've got lots of options at this point.
That's great. Thanks, Peter.
Your next question comes from the line of James Rethan from Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Peter, good morning. Just a few questions, please. The first one is on the oil production unit costs. They declined quite substantially from previous years, down to $19 a barrel. Just want to understand the drive behind that and if that's sustainable. And then I've got two more follow-ons, please.
Short answer is yes, it is sustainable, although next year, as you know, we're planning to take the Ngujima Yin out of service sometime through the first half of next year as we take it up to Singapore and start to fit it out to get ready for the Greater Enfield project. The reason it's sustainable, one is we've taken some Belknaps costs out of there, so that's a big part of that. But equally, we've got this process or project within Woodside. It's called One FPSO, and that's been a big driver of getting synergies across that FPSO business and driving those costs out. So it's been a you know, an excellent effort on behalf of the guys at showing how we can squeeze the back end of this. Of course, we've got Laminari Corallina has also gone out. So we've had a couple of assets drop out, but with respect to looking forward, I'm looking at Mike Utzler at the moment. Mike's nodding his head and assuring me that he can maintain these sorts of ranges on those unit operating costs.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Now, just in terms of going back to the LNG market macro question, Qatar recently announced plans to increase their exports from 77 million tonnes to 100 by 2024. How do you see that impacting on Woodside's ability to sign long-term LNG offtake agreements for projects such as Browse in that environment of increased exports from Qatar, which is a low-cost country? Thanks.
Well, Browse is going to be low cost as well, James. So and of course Browse has liquids like the Qataris have. No, look, we expect that Qataris will target a different market. We expect a lot of it will actually go to Pakistan and India as the Qataris establish or re-establish those relationships there. And as you know, they've already got significant volumes going to both those countries. If I step back from it and, you know, you move away from the sticker shock, so to speak, of, oh, goodness, the Qataris are coming back in, the key here is it is a vote of confidence that the market's going to open up at a particular point in time, and the lowest cost producer is basically saying we want to participate in that when it opens up. So it does, you know, the positive part about it is they are signalling, they're seeing the same things we are, and they want to make sure buyers are considering their volumes when buyers are looking at the options they have for the projects. So it's just simply, in my view at the moment, a signal from the Qataris that we will have projects, we will have volumes available, and buyers, when you are looking at your options, make sure you keep us on your list. That's the first part. The second part is they won't directly compete with us, but equally what will happen is those who may have been competing in the markets that Qataris will target will move and compete with us in the markets that we would be targeting. So there will be a ripple effect there. My view is that only the lowest cost projects will move. So once buyers come back into the market, only the lowest cost projects will move. That'll be maybe the first 5 to 7 projects thereabouts. And then there'll be a period of time that the market will then soak that up, and then the next group of projects will move. So we're trying to position our projects to be in that first group, and we think the proposition we have, which is essentially an offshore development going into brownfield infrastructure, is a very attractive one. And we still need, buyers still need geographic diversification. So when you start looking at shipping costs and so forth, we're still very competitive in the market with the buyers that would be targeted. So, no, it's more competition, but equally, the Qataris have demonstrated a discipline over time to maintain price and have never been a lost loser in the market with respect to price. So the number of things. I might be concerned with somebody else who were noted lost losers in the market, but the Qataris have never been that.
Okay, thank you. Thanks a lot. And just one more quick one, if I may. Concept Select for Browse is targeting the second half of this year, which we all believe is backfilled to Northwest Shelf. However, if hypothetically Woodside was to acquire Exxon's 50% stake in Scarborough, would that change things at all, or do you see Scarborough being used to supply a second train at Pluto rather than backfill to Northwest Shelf? Thank you.
Well, both can be done hypothetically. So with respect to Browns going into Northwest Shelf, there's a lot of work to be done between now and when that concept is selected. We're targeting the end of this year. It may slip into early next year, but it will be just simply process more than anything else, just lining everybody up. On Scarborough, we've always said we believe Scarborough can either go into the Northwest Shelf probably 2 to 3 years after Browse starts in there. So if you look at the ullage profile, you'll start to see ullage freeing up then. Equally, we like the idea of Scarborough going into Pluto and having a tie line across to the Northwest Shelf. So we don't see them as mutually exclusive. The challenge is obviously going to be funding during that period and risk management around capital being deployed in the construction phase of two major projects, and that's something that we'll look closely at.
Okay, excellent, Peter. Thank you very much.
Thanks, James.
Your next question comes from the line of Andrew Hodge from Macquarie. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Peter. I've just got three questions. First one was just on the capital side. Given that most of the projects you guys have been doing at the moment, and I think you even talked before about Greater Western Flank 2 wells being 25% below FID budget, do you think that there's a possibility of bringing that cost down further and also accelerating both that and Greater Enfield start time?
Look, the answer to that is, we've made a commitment to investors, and that's embodied in the FID and the budget that we've agreed with our joint venture partners. The reality is, yes, clearly we're targeting coming in under those numbers and getting it done sooner. We're about 28% or thereabouts through Greater Enfield. We've just finished the scope on the work that will be in the yard up in Singapore. We're very pleased with where that is, and we've just locked in scope, so there'll be no scope change at all. So we know what we're doing in that regard. We're ordering subsea equipment and so forth, and we're seeing no delays in that we were previously. So there's no pressure at all, so to speak, on delivery times and so on. What I would say is there's an opportunity for us. I can't tell you what that opportunity is at this point. I know what I'm squeezing my team to do, but the reality is our focus is on ensuring that we meet the commitments we make to shareholders to ensure that that's bankable, and then you can be assured we're working really, really hard to beat that.
Okay. The second one is on trading. I mean, if I look kind of over the last 3 years, both trading revenue and costs have been dropping pretty significantly. Are you guys backing away from doing trading? Because, I mean, it's been a pretty big delta and sort of halved over this year to last year and then fallen significantly from where it was before that as well.
Right. Yeah, look, we always said we were setting up trading to be an optimizer and to be something that was going to protect the value of our existing business, understanding that the majority of our investment is in the upstream and midstream assets through the LNG plants. And so we wanted to make sure our trading activity were complementary to that and protected those assets or those investments. The difference is in trading, and it's difficult in the way that we show the segments, is that the traders in Singapore move both between project cargoes and then cargoes that come onto the spot market. And so they work both of those, Andrew, and so you don't see that in the numbers. So they are working hard, but often it's just a mix change that they're out there trading on behalf of Pluto, for example, a Pluto cargo in the marketplace that will be accounted for under the Pluto segment. If it's a spot cargo, a true spot cargo, then they'll go and pick that up. What we've decided to do this year, though, given the volatility in the trading business, is to charter out our vessels to the extent that we can, let others take that risk on vessels at this point. And so we've had a couple of our trading vessels sub-chartered to others during this period, just simply to assure ourselves of getting an appropriate revenue stream back in. And I'm pleased to see charter rates are starting to firm up. So, as you know, they are down as low as $20,000 to $25,000 per day earlier in the year, and now they're up above $35,000. So that's been our strategy, is actually to deploy our assets and let somebody else work them in this period where trading really hasn't delivered a lot of returns to people.
Okay. And I guess tying into that as well, my question is really just, I mean, you talked in Gas Tech earlier this year and then at the Investor Day as well about LNG markets. But I guess given the weak implied pricing at from Pluto coming from this quarter, and then talk of Gale trying to renegotiate pricing contracts with Cheniere, are you concerned at all about trying to go ahead with new projects like doing Northwest Shelf backfill on Browse and the kind of pricing that you guys would get, given that most of the numbers now are sort of looking at 11% slopes?
I think if you were to get a major project away today, you're down in that range, and so you've got to expect that that's where you're going to be. But there are no major projects getting away today at that range, so that's kind of the chicken and egg. Those slopes are really coming out in the marketplace for short to mid-term contracts, not the big long-term ones. So it'd be difficult for me to see anything getting away at an 11 slope without a corresponding increase in the constant. And you know, historically, that's what's been done. So if we go back 10 or 15 years, slopes used to be sub 10%, and the constants used to be a lot higher. And then as the resource owners, so to speak, got the whip hand in those negotiations, the constants went away, and of course it all went to slope to try and maximise the exposure to oil price. So these things ebb and flow, and so we've looked at it and said, really, what's a market bearable price? And we're setting our projects to be a market bearable price, and then we're basically back solving for it through the slope and constant. So that's how we're doing it. Look, there was a previous question as well around, you know, how far is Woodside willing to go to create markets, and are we still looking at FSRUs and potentially power gen on the back of that? And the answer to that is yes, we are, and we've looked at a number of opportunities and we'll continue to look at them. We actually probably in the near term have some opportunities that we're pursuing in at home here in the Pilbara, not on the East Coast, but in the Pilbara in the West, around trucking and getting LNG into some of the mining activities up here. So there seems to be a small fledgling market there that could open up to something much larger in the future. And then on FSRUs, you know, it's very competitive out there at the moment. So we're actually pleased. We've been party to a number of opportunities that we've looked at, and others have taken them. We're fine, because every one of those that we lose, so to speak, is one that we don't have to invest in, and it means that volume is going into the market. And that's really what we're into. Our business is not as an FSRU owner and developer, our business is around producing and selling LNG, and we need to always be mindful of that. That's where we want to make sure our capital is deployed.
Right. So coming back to the question, so you actually didn't. So you're saying that the contract, that renegotiated contract that you guys signed back in March for Pluto, you didn't sign at a slope that was significantly lower than where you were at before, and you're not concerned about signing, recontracting in the next couple of years when you have contracts coming up at low slopes as well, given the oversupply.
No, I think as contracts come up for renewal, there's, you know, each contract has certain clauses with respect to how much it can actually change. But no, we're concerned about all of those things as contracts come up for renewal. So, you know, you've got contracts coming up at less than 12% on new contracts. Old contracts, you know, the slopes we're seeing around 14%. And that's what we've been able to renegotiate our current North West Shelf projects around. So I just think it's whatever the contract is and who the buyer is and the conditions in the contract. For us, you might be referring back to the midterm contracts that we had with the Koreans.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, of course, they're a small part of our portfolio, but they were renegotiated at prevailing conditions. So, no, we didn't repeat what we got back in 2014, but we knew that. We knew that all along. So, you know, I would look at that and say, let's go focus on the bottom line. The bottom line is we're able to increase our EBITDA margin. We're able to increase our cash flow in the business. We had allowed for all of these things in our business model, and our break-even cost, cash cost in our business is at around $34 per BOE. So all of that was factored in, Andrew, as we looked at where we thought slopes were going and renegotiations in contracts. So no surprises for us with respect to our business plan.
Okay. Thanks, Peter.
Your next question comes from the line of Jamie Smith from Financial Times. Please go ahead.
Oh, hello there. I've just got a question about the use of floating LNG technology. You know, you've seen the Prelude facility arriving off the coast of Australia. Can you just explain why Woodside decided against using FLNG for its Browse resource? Was it purely economics, or was there something to the fact that this is a very new technology and unproven? And then is floating LNG completely off your agenda for the medium term, or would you consider it?
Okay. No, we've been very clear on Browse. The Browse was an economic decision. It was based on the break-even price that we could get the cost of supply down to. And we've indicated to market previously that we couldn't get that number below $50 at the time that we were looking at, $50 per BOE. $50 Brent equivalent, I should say. And so what we said is the technology in its current mode could only deliver that, and that's a particular technology, a particular size and capacity, and it included coming out of a Korean shipyard at that point in time. So all of those factors were included. And what we saw is on the Browse development, the market was able to move down quite significantly with respect to the subsea, the drilling and the surf costs. But we weren't able to get corresponding decreases in the cost of the vessel itself. And then somewhat that was, one, the design, meaning, you know, once you've designed something, it kind of costs what it is. And then the second one was the flexibility in the shipyards to take costs out of their structure. And we saw that that was limited in that regard. So it was just simply an economic decision. With respect to technology, we're already seeing technology move on quite rapidly. So we pursued Browse in the first place, and that we felt we could design one, build many, and get advantages out of that. But once you move away from that, you then start to look at technology advances, and we're already seeing quite significant capacity enhancements on these vessels coming through. So, you know, what we're seeing at Browse today, or with the original Browse design, now the same capacity might be 15% more. than what it was in the original browse design. So you're seeing advances quite quickly. Do we still believe in FLNG? Yes, we do, but we've always said it's for the right application. So we won't invest in FLNG simply to be a market leader in a particular technology. We'll be driven by the commerciality of the project itself and ensuring that it's the lowest cost solution.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Your next question comes from the line of Mark Samter from Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Yeah, morning, guys. I might change jobs and become a journalist, so I get higher up the list on the questions. My first question is on browse. I look at Shell and BP in their latest presentations. These companies are pretty good at giving their list of possible conceptual projects, and for neither of them, browse even features. I guess, should we see this as maybe their Australian offices are a bit more enthusiastic, but somewhere between here and The Hague and London, that enthusiasm gets lost, or should we think that maybe you need to see some JV changes to progress the project? Can we just get your view on that?
Look, we apologies, Mark, that you weren't in the right spot on the list. We read the same things, but we stay very well connected both between the group here in Australia and, of course, the corporate headquarters, and I meet with the CEOs of those companies on a regular basis. So we're aligned on where we wish to get to, and that's an FID on browse sometime in 2019-2020 is where we're heading to. And I think if depending on which house you speak to, they'll tell you either 2019 or 2020. For us, it's the earlier part of that. For a couple of it's the latter part of that. I think the key is the project will go to FID when it's ready. And what we've got to do is just work through each stage to make this a compelling investment proposition for them. So we believe it is. The fact that they haven't put it on their charts just, in my view, just tells you where they are in their own maturity of it. Equally, you know, we could form a view there are some projects on those charts that may not progress in the time frame that are put on there as well. So, you know, it's kind of one of those ones of, you know, how mature are you internally with respect to the development? What gates have they gone through? And so what are you comfortable in sharing with the market? And, you know, it just appears maybe with a couple of our joint venture partners, they're not quite as mature in their internal process. But I wouldn't read anything more into it than that at this point.
Okay. Perfect. And then second question, I think in one of the questions you seem to suggest that you weren't looking at the East Coast for FSRUs. I'm just curious why, because I think if you take the ADGSM at its face value, the GLNG contract, which is a very high-priced contract, sets domestic gas price, then you get plus transportation cost to Victoria, which means you could be landing gas. I mean, even if you do have to...
Yeah, look, we've read your comments during the week. We've been very consistent on this, is that we don't take exception to the view that there could be an investment proposition with an FSRU. We've just said it's not for Woodside, and the reason for that is quite simple. We'd love to be a supplier into it, but we're not market facing, and we think an FSRU is best developed by somebody who's a market facing company, meaning that they can aggregate customers on the market side and then de-risk the investment or the commitment. So, you know, it'd be no good, to be honest, Mark, for us to go put an FSRU in and then put up an auction and say, guys, come and buy gas from me in a domestic market that I actually don't play in today. So it's just around risk management for us. But with respect to the overall proposal and the numbers floating around and so forth, you know, we've consistently said we don't take exception to the concept at all, and we'd love to be asked to tender into supplying it.
Okay, perfect. Thanks, guys.
Your next question comes from the line of John Hergy from Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. A question, if I can, Peter, in terms of your guidance for 2017. You haven't reaffirmed it here, but shall we just take it as read that it's reconfirmed?
Yes, it is, John. So in the absence of anything else, it's reconfirmed. You're aware we've had some unplanned production outages during during first half. We don't expect, we don't have any large planned outages during second half. You know, we've had Pluto down for a short period post the end of the half, but it's back up and running, so that's all factored into our numbers. You know, so I'd say, you know, guidance is still there. There's probably pressure on the upside, but you know, the guidance range is still pretty firm. And again, Mike Utz was nodding his head and telling me that he's gonna surprise me again. So read it as that. We'll just go to our normal update. Typically, it's after our third quarter results that we'll give you an update as to run into the end of the year. And at that point, we'll have a pretty good fix on where Wheatstone is as well, so we'll be able to incorporate that in.
Yep. Okay, another question, if I may, and just extending on the comments you just made about an FSRU on the East Coast. As you know, one of the East Coast-based utilities is looking at Victoria as a possible site. There was some talk that having LNG sourced from Australia would require LNG ships to be manned by Australian crews and things like that. Therefore, the cost may be high. Can you elaborate if that's a correct assertion that's been made about sourcing LNG from Australia to supply into the East Coast?
You're learning a lot about the shipping industry, I can see. Yeah, the short answer is yes. So if it's sourced from, comes from an Australian source, then for it to not be manned by an Australian crew, it needs to go out of Australia. If you're doing a intracoastal trade, then it will need an Australian crew. You're exactly right.
Okay. So presumably costs may be somewhat higher than, say, offshore crews. From that perspective. So that would be something that you would look to from your portfolio perspective, right, as being one way to manage that that price risk, if you like.
Yeah, I think what you would see is people would manage that from portfolios. So they would bring those cargoes from somewhere else. That wouldn't be a direct sale from an Australian asset around the coast. And you'd swap an Australian cargo somewhere else in the world. So, again,
yep.
It comes to managing your shipping and knowing and having control of that. So, for as an example, it might be a cargo out of Northwest Shelf or Pluto goes somewhere in Asia, and then we swap that with a cargo in Asia and bring that down. I think most suppliers would be looking at the same thing.
Hmm. And finally, in terms of Wheatstone, I think Anthea made a point during her presentation that the costs have gone up slightly. Can you just give us some quantification on that, please?
Yeah, most of that's timing, John. So Anthea was referring to the fact that this year we're going to spend more in this year than what was in our original plan. But it's just timing as we bring forward activities.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Peter.
By the way, to complete that, the joint venture, as in its usual process, goes through an update of final costs in early, late third quarter, early fourth quarter. So, you know, if we're to provide any more guidance, you know, you can expect it'll be as we come in towards the end of the year.
Your next question comes from the line of Wei Wen Chen from JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Hi, Peter. Just a quick question on the rise of non-traditional buyers in the LNG market. Is there a direct opportunity here for Woodside to sign long-term contracts with emerging importers such as Pakistan and Bangladesh, or would the counterparty risk be prohibitive?
Look, it's a good question. For a number of those, there is counterparty risk for us, but equally what you're seeing is traders are getting into that market. So, for example, both Bangladesh and Pakistan have done a government-to-government deal, and so that counterparty risk is managed between the respective governments. But as you saw when Egypt started to evolve, the traders started to come in, so the big, large trading entities, they're able to take on that counterparty risk in the early days. So we would look at that, or we'd look at either selling into a trader's volume that they've gone and secured, or equally we would look at it directly. Pakistan at the moment is not quite there for us, but some of the other emerging parties are. there are a lot of new players in China in particular, kind of the second level players starting to come into the market, and of course understanding their creditworthiness is often a challenge, but they are new markets we're going to have to look at, and we're going to have to look at our treasury risk management on this to see what our appetite is.
Great, thanks. And the other question I had was, can you maybe speak about some of the outages that have occurred at sort of Northwest Shelf and Pluto? Have they highlighted anything that you're concerned about?
The two Northwest Shelf outages have been due to power supply trips. The first one was in a substation, and the second one was actually in an area that we'd already worked on in the plant, so we're still finalising the investigation into that. Look, it does tell you that the work we're currently doing around refurbishment is probably very timely, and so it's the right thing for us to be doing. But it's hard for me to join the dots yet and say, look, I've got a common theme here, other than we've had two rather significant trips in the Northwest Shelf this year. Pluto itself has just had a number of small trips. Last year we had a very clean run. This year we've had a number of small trips that have been typically 24 hours or so. We've had one recently where we just took the plant down for a short period of time to do some planned maintenance. A lot of it, though, we're putting down to the fact we've had very unusual weather conditions in the first quarter up in Karratha. So whereas last year it was dry, basically, we had very low rainfall. This year we've had torrential rainfall up there, and it's just continuing to work its way into the system. So I'm looking, hoping that it's all going to dry out here and we're going to get a nice, clean run at it. We know how to run the plant, so I wouldn't expect that it's anything untoward. And you might recall previously we've said, as we've gone through a number of our process improvement initiatives, that one of the things we'll make sure we look at is the reliability of the plants as we go through that, and we don't compromise in any way. So I wouldn't say at the moment that I'm seeing any signs of that, but I am very much paying attention to it.
Great. Thank you.
I think that's it, guys. Well, look, again, thanks very much for joining Woodside this morning on our first half results. As I said, we're pleased to present to shareholders an increased profit up some 49%, an increased dividend up 44%. You've seen strong cash flow out of the business. We're living within our means, so we've managed that juggling act of what we've committed to on capital out of the company. We're living within our means. You can see our cost of debt is low. We're continuing to look at the markets with respect to managing our debt profile as we go out into the future. We're moving our growth projects along nicely, and we're exposed to some excellent exploration prospects as we finish up the second half of this year. So all in all, the organisation is delivering on the plans that we said we would. We've got our cost structures under control and in place. And so I'd say we're looking forward to reporting to you our full-year results. Again, thanks very much for your interest and your questions this morning. And with that, we'll finish up.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may all disconnect.